On this episode of Skeptico, author of DMT, The Spirit Molecule, Dr. Rick Strassman.
All the folks, virtually all, of the near-death experience researchers come to the conclusion sooner or later that consciousness must exist outside of the brain. How do we process that?
Well, it isn't a new idea, obviously. Spiritual traditions have believed it and taught it and have practiced it. It is a new idea, within the Western scientific model. So one of the analogies that I make in the DMT book is the brain is a receiver as opposed to a generator of a particular channel of consciousness, channel normal, as it were. And under extreme, situations, then the channel switches. And the result of, being given DMT is, now able to perceive channels of information that it couldn't before. If you change your perspective on, the relationship between the brain and consciousness, then things start to become a bit clearer, but at the same time, a bit more mind-boggling, too.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and today we welcome Dr. Rick Strassman, author of DMT, The Spirit Molecule, a fascinating book about his research with a psychedelic drug that causes some amazing out-of-body spiritual experiences. Here's my interview with Rick. Today we welcome Dr. Rick Strassman, author of DMT, The Spirit Molecule. Rick is also a distinguished academic and researcher, having received an MD in psychiatry, a postgraduate fellowship in pharmacology, and having a distinguished teaching and research career at the University of New Mexico. Rick, welcome to Skeptico.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, I want to jump right in the middle of this, as I was just saying in the little bit of time we had before this interview. I'm sure a lot of people are familiar with your work, particularly this book about DMT. And if they're not, then they're going to have to kind of brush up on and on their own, because we're going to jump into the middle of this. But let me give a very short introduction and correct anything that I might get wrong. But in the 1990s, you were a researcher at the University of New Mexico, and you received approval, which is an amazing story in itself, to inject volunteers with this psychedelic drug, DMT, and then to evaluate the effects. And here's part of what you said about the results of those experiments. This is a quote from you in another interview I found. It's a great quote. "The most interesting results were that high doses of DMT seemed to allow the consciousness of our volunteers to enter an out-of-body, freestanding, independent realm of existence inhabited by beings of light who oftentimes were expecting the volunteers and with whom the volunteers interacted." Okay, so correct if any of that's wrong, and just also if you want to elaborate on that, because that's quite a lot for people to kind of wrap their minds on around right from the beginning.
Right. Well, that's pretty much the case. That's true, everything you said. Yeah, that's a good summary too, actually.
So tell us a little bit about that research. I'm sure you've done it a million times, but the kind of elevator speech, what was that all about?
Well, I performed my studies between 1990 and 95, and ostensibly it was a study to investigate effects and the mechanisms of action of a drug of abuse, which was DMT. I had ulterior motives, though, at the same time, and these were to understand better the biology of spiritual experience, especially naturally occurring spiritual experience, which might take place through meditation or as a result of a close, brush with death. Even psychotic states, sometimes partake of spiritual properties. And I was, drawn to DMT because it's a naturally occurring compound in the human body. It also occurs in every other mammal which has been investigated to date, and it also is found in either hundreds of plants or even thousands of plants. So as a candidate for a compound in the human body which could produce, you know, mystical or spiritual experiences, DMTs, you know, seem like the reasonable candidate. And, you know, along the lines of the ulterior motives for my study, I was interested in comparing the responses to giving DMT in people, you know, to descriptions of spontaneous spiritual experiences which occur without the drug. And if I was able to determine significant overlaps or, you know, similarities in those two states, you know, then to that extent, I could argue, you know, for the possible involvement of endogenous DMT in those spontaneous, you know, non, you know, drug-induced experiences. So,
right. I was just going to interject. One thing I found interesting is you said that you hope your work, and I don't know if this was at the time or later, but help might break down the dichotomy between the spiritual and the physical. And I think that's a very, very interesting point. And I want to get into that, but I just wanted to frame up the DMT research one little bit more and have you comment on it, because what your research wound up doing, and I don't know if this was your intent or not, but to a certain degree, you provided independent confirmation of some aspects of this experience that many indigenous people around the world for hundreds of years have talked about. So, you know, a lot of people know about ayahuasca in the Amazon, and that people who experience ayahuasca have the experience that you just talked about, leaving the body or another realm. And what really intrigued me was, it seemed like where your research led you, and I guess the question in this is, did you see this coming, was that DMT seemed to lift the veil to some kind of interdimensional reality that we don't understand, but did you at all see that coming when you started this research?
Well, you know, I kind of did and I kind of didn't. You know, I was, you know, more expecting the kinds of experiences more typical of, you know, the Zen enlightenment experience, you know, kind of without form, without ideas, without concepts, without images, also without an interacting, you know, sense of self. You know, and I think a lot of, you know, the current interest in brain spirituality issues, either consciously or unconsciously, is taking on kind of the Buddhist point of view, you know, which is all of this spiritual, you know, content is a product of the mind, as opposed to being perceived by the mind. And, you know, the part I didn't expect, you know, was the more interactive ego maintenance, you know, types of experiences which were full of content and, you know, full of images. You know, the personality of the volunteer could still interact, you know, quite willfully with what was going on in their, you know, DMT state. You know, so it was a spiritual experience for the volunteers, but the type of the spiritual experience, or, you know, the quality of it, was what caught me unawares.
I think I heard you say that it was, you found it surprising that it was relational,
right,
versus that unifying all through nothing kind of Buddhist kind of interpretation of it. Do you want to elaborate on that?
Yeah, the experience of enlightenment, you know, to what I understand of it anyway, is it's unformed and uncreated and uninteracting in a way. You know, you interact with it, but you know, the interaction is, you know, more of a beholding and emerging, as opposed to kind of, you know, willfully, you know, making decisions about, you know, what to ask and, you know, how to respond, you know, to these entities or these beings which one perceives in the DMT state.
I want you to dig into that a little bit. For the skeptical-minded folks that come and say, what do you mean that's reality-based? I mean, we got a bunch of problems in pulling that apart. I mean, it's all subjective, but then we do have this consensus reality that people can come back and report a lot of things that are similar, and then we say, yeah, that's real. Tear that apart. What do you mean these DMT experiences were real?
Well, that's a good question. And, you know, there's a number of criteria. You know, one is, you know, sense of, you know, temporal continuity. you know, both in what's going on in that state. In other words, you know, B follows A, and then, you know, C follows B, and you can track what's going on in the world around you. You know, that's, you know, one of the definitions, or, you know, one of the criteria, anyway. Also, there's, you know, the maintenance of a, you know, sense of self in that state. You know, so that also is a criteria, you know, which is met, I think, in the DMT state. And ultimately, though, you know, one, you know, kind of ends up deciding what's real, you know, kind of based on overall gestalt of, you know, it, you know, feeling real. You know, does this, you know, feel real compared to other, you know, real experiences, you know, that somebody has had? And ultimately, you know, that was, you know, the criterion which the DMT, you know, volunteers, you know, kind of based, you know, their statements of the DMT state, you know, being so real. You know, they even described it as you know, being more real than real. You know, they could clearly distinguish it from a dream or other kinds of, you know, auditory or, you know, visual types of unusual experiences, which, you know, they may have had in the past, you know, but also compared to everyday reality. It just, you know, felt, you know, more real than everyday reality.
Okay, so reality we kind of covered. What about the other word we've been kicking around, spiritual? Are DMT experiences by nature spiritual? Do they always create a spiritual experience? What is a spiritual experience? How do we define that?
Yeah. Oh, well, you know, Aristotle, you know, defined spiritual as, you know, non-corporeal, you know, non-physical. In, you know, some ways, you know, that's a good start, because the kinds of experiences, you know, that the DMT volunteers, you know, underwent were, you know, the perceptions and the interactions with, you know, non-corporeal things. And, you know, most of the time, you know, people don't, you know, think of light as corporeal. I suppose you can, but, you know, most of the time, as, you know, compared to, you know, things like wood or stone or things like that, you know, light is incorporeal, or, you know, relatively incorporeal. Also, you know, spiritual experience in, you know, some ways is an extension, you know, like a qualitative extension of everyday reality. There are, you know, more intense emotions as opposed to being, you know, happy or, you know, feeling sad. It's ecstasy or terror. You know, so those are more kind of quantitative, you know, changes, you know, relative to everyday experience.
The whole discussion here about reality versus spiritual brings us back to this earlier snippet of a quote I had from you, where you said that you hope your work will break down the dichotomy between the spiritual and the physical. And I think that's what you're doing right here in this description. But maybe do you want to elaborate on that a little bit and take a little bit further? Why would we want to? Why is that a good idea? Why are we headed towards breaking down the dichotomy between the spiritual and the physical?
Well, there's a couple of, you know, elements to your question. You know, if you, you know, think about, you know, DMT, it's a drug, it's a chemical, and, you know, we understand its, you know, mechanisms in the brain. At the same time, it is a chemical which, you know, seems to provide access to spiritual states of consciousness, or at least states of consciousness which have, you know, traditionally been considered spiritual. You know, so it's kind of a, you know, transitional point. Well, that's the reason I call it the spirit molecule. It's kind of a, you know, paradox in a way. The spirit is non-corporeal and, you know, the molecule is corporeal.
Let's talk about NDEs a little bit, because near-death experience research is a topic we've covered a lot on this show, because it seems to me to really get at the heart of some of these issues regarding consciousness and spirituality. And my read of this research from the folks that I've talked to on this show, it seems to indicate that it's highly suggestive that consciousness continues after clinical death, or at least after some point at which the brain is not the way we normally think of a brain, without blood flow, without electricity, and all that stuff. So what is your understanding in terms of where NDE research is going, and how it fits with what you've discovered in your work with DMT?
So the whole issue of NDEs is interesting, you know, because I was actually anticipating a lot more of, you know, the classical kinds of, you know, near-death experiences in my volunteers than actually took place. And I was speculating, you know, that the occurrence would be a lot more, you know, common, you know, because of some speculations that I have put, you know, forth about the ability of stress-related release of DMT at, you know, the time of death. You know, that's purely speculative at this point, but still I was able, you know, to marshal substantial evidence, you know, suggesting, you know, that DMT, you know, could possibly increase as a result of the stress which occurs as you're approaching death. You know, the issue of consciousness existing after, you know, somebody dies is an important issue, obviously, with all kinds of implications, you know, for morality and we behave, you know, when we are alive. If our DMT, you know, research is any indication, it, you know, does seem that it is possible for consciousness to exist without, you know, being conscious of the body anyway. You know, one of the extremely common experiences in the DMT work was that after an injection of DMT, you know, the consciousness of the volunteer, you know, left the body. The internal pressure of the state was, you know, such that it just couldn't be contained in the body anymore. And almost everybody, in response to a large dose of DMT, you know, felt their body unable to contain the experience. And their, you know, their consciousness, you know, left the body, and it was a disembodied consciousness, you know, that beheld the DMT experience or state.
That's fascinating, but we have to kind of probe that. What does that mean? It so totally overthrows our understanding of not only consciousness, but what it means to be alive, what it means to be human, and yet that is exactly my read of the near-death experience research, and I've just had tons of people or dozens of people on the show who aren't familiar with the research and want to argue another point, but all the folks, virtually all, of the near-death experience researchers come to the conclusion sooner or later that these experiences seem to be happening at a time when there is no brain, when they are clinically dead in the brain, and therefore consciousness must exist outside of the brain. How do we process that?
Well, how do we process it? It isn't a new idea, obviously. You know, the Tibetans have been, you know, talking about it, you know, for centuries. Their, you know, religions, spiritual traditions, you know, have believed it and, you know, taught it and have, you know, practiced it, you know, getting people ready to die. You know, so it isn't a, you know, new idea. It is a new idea, you know, within the Western, you know, scientific model. But still, you know, Ken Ring's work and, you know, Moody's work, you know, that's almost, you know, over 40 years old by now. So it is establishing, you know, some, you know, presence within, you know, the scientific, you know, model of things. But still, you know, how to understand it. So one of the analogies that I, you know, make in the DMT book is, you know, the brain is a receiver, you know, as opposed to a generator of a particular, you know, channel of consciousness, you know, channel normal, as it were. And under extreme, you know, situations, you know, then the channel switches. And, you know, as a result of, you know, being given DMT, you know, the brain is, you know, now able to perceive channels of information that it couldn't before. If you change your perspective on, you know, the relationship between the brain and consciousness, you know, then things start to become a bit clearer, but at the same time, a bit more mind-boggling, too.
Right, but it's such an important leap to make. So, you know, now let's jump over that chasm, because it's so much more fun on the other side to start speculating what that means and what this spiritual expanded consciousness might mean outside of this body, outside of this time frame that we're in. And I guess the starting point for that would be to ask you about how this has shifted your experience spiritually, personally. You know, what has your research done to you?
You know, kind of entered the study, you know, kind of a dyed-in-the-wool, you know, Zen Buddhist. I had over 20 years of experience and training and, you know, study and under the auspices of a Zen monastery. And, you know, I was expecting those kinds of enlightenment experiences from people getting DMT. And, you know, in a way, you know, the Zen view of things is a bit, you know, scientific, in quotes. It kind of posits that everything is a product of your mind, as opposed, you know, to these experiences actually, you know, representing external, freestanding, you know, other levels of, you know, reality. You know, so I could kind of hold, you know, the Zen, you know, model of the mind and also, you know, the brain model of the mind in, you know, fairly good balance. You know, they were pretty consistent with each other. And as a result of my studies, you know, that got overturned, you know, because the volunteers, even the ones with, you know, meditation practice, you know, Zen experience, they'd studied Buddhism, you know, this and that, you know, they were completely unprepared for the kinds of, you know, relational, you know, non-unitive experiences, you know, that were much more typical of the effects of DMT. You know, so after my studies ended, I kind of went back to the drawing board when it came to explanatory models. You know, I kind of toyed, you know, with other models, you know, scientific models, to explain the freestanding external, you know, reality basis of, you know, people's experiences. I, you know, touch upon some of the ideas regarding dark matter and parallel universes and those kinds of concepts. And, you know, those were helpful in terms of explaining the mechanisms of action, you know, let's say. At the same time, I even found, you know, those, you know, concepts and, you know, those models, you know, not that satisfactory because, you know, they were kind of skirting around the issue of the spiritual. I suppose I'm speaking of spiritual in, you know, this context as to the information that's contained in those states and what that information is, you know, good for.
Right, which is an important distinction. If I can just interject something, because I think it's really important distinction to say, you know, we can jump on this other side and kind of look at it really, we can look at it really analytically, kind of at an arm's length, or we can jump into the content and start pulling apart and putting back together the content in a way that makes sense. And I just think it's really brave and interesting of you to go there. I think it's brave for you to go there, but I also think it's very interesting and opens up a lot of doors that I wish more people would do, because whether it's right or wrong, at least you're taking a stab at it and saying, if the science gets us to this point, aren't we obligated to then do some content analysis on the information we're getting back here from these experiences?
Right, exactly. Yeah. And, you know, the scientific models, you know, they made sense, but at you know, the same time, they really didn't touch me in an emotional or, quote, spiritual, unquote, kind of way. You know, like, what does this mean? You know, what good is it for? Is it going to, you know, make the world a better place? You know, is it going, you know, to help us make, you know, popcorn more quickly or, you know, generate world peace more quickly? You know, you can always make a, you know, faster car and a bigger bomb, but, you know, can you, you know, promote world peace and, you know, kind of advocate for the poor and the widow? You know, so that's, you know, kind of when I began stepping out of, you know, both, you know, the scientific model and also in, you know, some ways the Buddhist model. You know, the Buddhist model is useful to a certain point. You know, it is a spiritual, you know, tradition, and it's got ethics and it's got morals, but, you know, those, you know, kind of, you know, come, you know, out of an, you know, differentiated state of enlightenment as opposed to being, you know, part and, you know, parcel of, you know, the actual spiritual experience. And as I was looking around, you know, for a tradition, you know, which made, you know, the ethical and the moral content part and, you know, parcel of the spiritual experience, I actually ended up, you know, back at the Hebrew Bible, you know, the Old Testament, of, you know, my younger days as a, you know, child in Hebrew school. And so over the last few years, I've been kicking around the idea of, you know, the Western spiritual, you know, pinnacle of spirituality as of the prophetic state, as described, you know, by the Old Testament prophets. It's, you know, if you read the accounts of Ezekiel or Isaiah or Jeremiah or of Moses or, you know, any of, you know, these great characters in the Bible, you know, their experiences are incredibly psychedelic. And also, you know, they comport quite, you know, closely with a number of the experiences of our DMT volunteers. You know, one of the strengths and, you know, the beauties of, you know, the Old Testament, you know, prophetic tradition is, you know, that the teaching, you know, the experience, you know, the words are in a, you know, Western context and also are just, you know, saturated with ethical and with moral teachings. You know, so I've been kind of trying to pull together a, you know, psychedelic view of the Old Testament as the content of the current book I'm, you know, working on right now.
Yeah, and that's fascinating. And I want to go there a little bit. One of the points that you raised that said kind of sent you on this other journey towards Judaism is this unitive versus relational. And that's that you expected more of a Buddhist kind of know-nothing God, and you found a relational, a someone who's there to guide you, some entity that you can interact with, or that's what your volunteers found. And it's interesting because I compare that to what I've come to understand from the near-death experience and from reading a lot of accounts and talking to researchers, and that, you know, one of the things that struck me was that this unitive aspect of it seems to be primary in the near-death experience. And there does seem to also be this relational part a lot of the time, but not all the time. And as a matter of fact, one of the leading researchers and a guy I really like because I like the way he presents is Jeff Long, a radiation oncologist out of Louisiana who's probably compiled and reviewed the largest database of near-death experiences. And I was just speaking with him the other day, and you know, his follow-on book is really about this unitive aspect of it, and that how the understanding that near-death experiencers come away with is this massively interconnected, that we're all one, that there is this one light, there is this one. Now, God may be getting into a little relational, but how do you pull that apart, or how do you see that? Does that fit in with your the experience of your volunteers?
It isn't, you know, consistent with the reports of my volunteers. I was just, you know, thinking about a book that I read a couple of years back, which, you know, talks about this issue. And he put together a very cool book called The Soul After Death. And, you know, he kind of talks about the frequency of the white, you know, light experience in contemporary NDEs. He's got an interesting take on it. You know, there's obviously a, you know, a lot of different ways, to interpret it. Well, so he was comparing, you know, the quality of, you know, contemporary, you know, near-death experiences with those, you know, from a long time ago are, you know, much more terrifying, and you're judged and you go through hell and you are attacked by demons and your, you know, faith is tested. So he, you know, proposes, you know, that one of the reasons, you know, that those experiences of the white light, especially one with the emotional qualities of being, you know, loving and accepting and those kinds of things, is a, you know, result of contemporary spiritual, you know, perspectives.
I'll certainly have to get Stephen Rose on the show. He sounds like he'd be a great guest. Of course, I was raised Greek Orthodox. Unlike you, I can't ever see myself going back to that religious tradition.
It's a pretty scary tradition. And actually, well, so he died actually a number of years back. So, you know, so you might have a hard time, you know, having him on your show.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. Well, you know, I was going to interject. Well, then we will go on and talk about it. So I will never have the opportunity to interview him. But I have to say that my understanding of near-death experience research would kind of contradict that in a couple of ways. One is that as the researchers have honed more in on the genuine death experience as opposed to the near-death, and that is they study cardiac arrest patients and interviewed them immediately after the incident, they found much less of the scary NDEs, or I guess in general, I could just say the quality of the NDE experience changed, and it changed based on that dimension, which I think is interesting because that suggests that maybe some of those other interpretations and perceptions of the near-death experience had come through a more conscious state or reinterpretation of it. But the other thing that I guess I'd say is when you look at it from kind of from a cultural perspective, which folks have done, and you analyze the near-death experience, it doesn't really hold up to the new age-ish feel-good God. The data really kind of supports that model.
Yeah, and you know, I didn't completely agree with his perspective either because of, you know, the cross-cultural consistency too. But it was an interesting spin on, you know, the friendly white light, you know, how commonly you know, that's encountered, you know, nowadays, as opposed to the harsh, judging, you know, righteous God out there.
The whole thing gets back to this question that we just touched on here and that you've raised in your work, and that's the degree to which our perception, our unique human experience, how that enters into our interpreting of this spiritual experience. And maybe you want to talk about that a little bit and how you found that in your volunteers, and also how that's factored into your own spiritual quest since then. You know, and let me add to that. We're kind of in this quandary because on one hand, there's such a prejudice against accepting people's spiritual experience, you know, and we tend to dismiss it so much in so many of the times in science, we tend to dismiss it or downgrade it. And yet at the same time, there's some evidence that suggests that we should be skeptical of even our own spiritual experience. And we do need to compare it with others before we kind of embrace it fully. Any thoughts on that?
In the case of most of my volunteers, you know, they were not expecting the kinds of experiences, you know, that they ended up having. It was a, you know, relatively common, refrain, you know, that I heard from the volunteers, you know, that they couldn't have expected, you know, what their experience was like. You know, they couldn't have imagined it. You know, they weren't anticipating it at all that way. You know, most of them were actually going into the study, you know, with the expectation and also the hope of a enlightenment, you know, kind of a Buddhist, you know, white light, you know, type of experience. So they were, as, you know, caught off guard and, you know, by surprise, you know, by the types of experiences that they ended up having as much as I was.
And let's drill into that a little bit because, you know, I have kind of maybe glossed over some issues that are going to leave some people behind, and a little bit of detail here I think might be interesting. So you have volunteers in New Mexico who don't know anything about the DMT experience, don't know anything about ayahuasca, and they have this experience and they see these reptilian beings that are similar to what these folks in the Amazon have seen for hundreds of years, right? I mean, you do have some kind of unexplainable correlation between what their experience is in terms of the beings and these beings that indigenous people have experienced for a long time, right?
Yeah, and, you know, I performed my studies, you know, between, you know, 1990 and 1995, and you know, Terrence McKenna's stuff hadn't really, you know, become quite as, you know, popular as it, you know, became subsequently with respect to, you know, his descriptions of the sort of freestanding quality of the DMT world. I don't think any of my volunteers were especially interested in, you know, UFOs or, you know, the abduction experience to any extent. And ayahuasca still hadn't really emerged from the jungle as a popular cultural kind of item.
Interesting. Let me shift back and talk about this prophecy work that you're doing, because it's fascinating, it's challenging at the same time. Here's a quote from an article that I read of yours, or an interview actually with you, and it says that you believe there's tremendous power in the Old Testament Bible. When you say that, do you mean as opposed to the New Testament Bible, as opposed to the Bhagavad Gita, the Tibetan Book of the Dead, to other sacred, in quotes, scripture?
Oh, I suppose in terms of the Old Testament, it's an old book, obviously. It's, you know, a couple thousand, 2,500 years old. It's, you know, kind of what the New Testament stands on in a way. You know, the New Testament relies upon the Old Testament as, you know, confirming Jesus as, you know, the Messiah. And even in, you know, the Quran, there's quite a few, or, you know, there's quite a few instances of you know, Old Testament stories in the Quran, you know, either verbatim or, you know, reworked. And if you take into account all the Muslims, all the Christians, and all the Jews in the world, you know, close to, you know, one half of the world's population. And it's got staying power, the Bible. It still has a tremendous amount of influence. The Hebrew Bible, I think its perspective has, you know, really influenced every aspect of the West. You know, Western science, Western philosophy, Western law.
Rick, no one would argue any of those points with you, but you seem to be going someplace different, someplace further, and that's okay. I just want to understand that. You seem to be bridging this gap between spiritual reality and the Bible, and that's okay. I just want to understand what that means for you, what that bridge is like.
Well, sure. You know, so the power of, you know, the Bible, I think, you know, kind of hinges on the prophetic state of mind out of which the text emerged. The power isn't, you know, just because it gives good advice about law or economics. Its good advice is as a result of, you know, the source of, you know, the information in the first place. And, you know, that source of information is, you know, the prophetic state of consciousness, which I am, you know, going to argue is a, you know, psychedelic state with, you know, features in common, you know, with the DMT experience.
So the New Testament characters that we're talking about, Ezekiel and the rest, were having psychedelic experiences, going into these other realms, bringing back information that we might want to pay attention to and might be relevant to our current situation.
Well, yeah, yeah, for sure. It's, you know, relevant. You know, I mean, everybody knows the story of Adam and Eve and Abraham and Isaac and the Red Sea and the Ten Commandments, all that. You know, so they are relevant. You know, but the issue is, you know, where did that information come from? And, you know, can, you know, is it possible, you know, for us to understand it, to tap into it ourselves? And, you know, so that's, you know, where the psychedelic element of, you know, the prophetic state comes into play. You know, if you know, DMT is a naturally occurring compound, which occurs, you know, possibly as a result of increased stress or, or, you know, one's biological, you know, constitution, you know, being so composed, you know, that DMT, you know, could be released, you know, spontaneously, you know, more often in one person, you know, than another. You could speculate that it is related to what you could call a prophetic state of consciousness. And if you want to understand your psychedelic experience in you know, Western terms and applicable, you know, to the Western mind and the Western culture, you know, the Bible, you know, could be a extremely helpful guidebook, you know, to understand your experiences and to shape them and to apply them, you know, more than a shamanic, you know, model might be or an Eastern religious model might be.
Great. I was with you right up until the end. That end really surprised me. Why more than? If this has occurred the way that you think it's occurred, isn't it reasonable to assume that it's occurred in other traditions at other places and other times around the planet?
Yeah, you know, there's no question. You know, at the same time, you know, we're not jungle dwellers and, you know, we're not Asians, at least, you know, me and you. So we have a background and we have a language and, you know, we even have, you know, genes, I would imagine, which are uniquely Western. So I think with respect, you know, to the Western view of spirituality and, you know, Western culture and, you know, the Western mind, you know, the Bible, I think, you know, would be more applicable, you know, than Buddhism, let's say, or Hinduism or Shamanism, just because, you know, those really aren't our cultures. You know, that's, you know, not our parents' culture, our grandparents' culture, our great-grandparents' culture.
I hear you, and nice points. Reclaim the Bible, reclaim our tradition. I just want to make sure you're not suggesting that that tradition is somehow superior, better, straighter path to true knowing, ultimate truth, anything like that? Is there some preferred position, some preferred status that the Bible holds above other sacred text?
No. I think it came out of the Middle East 3,000 years ago or more. So for people whose, you know, genes and whose minds and whose culture, you know, are, you know, direct, you know, descendants of, you know, that text, I think it, you know, could be more relevant. So it's interesting to speculate regarding different, you know, naturally occurring psychedelics. You know, I had, you know, made reference to, you know, 5-methoxy-DMT as, you know, more typically, you know, generating a enlightenment kind of experience, you know, kind of a unitive into, you know, conceptless, imageless, you know, kind of existence. So it's interesting, you know, to kind of wonder if, you know, the Asian religions, if their practitioners and, you know, founders, if, you know, their biology may have slightly differed, you know, from that of the West in, you know, terms of, you know, perhaps producing, you know, more of one type of endogenous hallucinogen than another.
I don't know. I don't see how we quite get there, given that India and the Buddhist tradition came out of the Hindu tradition would be highly relational, I guess, in your model. I mean, mediated by all sorts of different beings that sound a lot like a DMT trip. So I don't know.
So that could be. And, you know, clearly the Tibetan, you know, tradition is quite, you know, full of beings and of deities and things like that. And, you know, if you scratch below the surface, I think you would find in you know, the Tibetan, you know, tradition, you know, that those aren't completely or, you know, entirely understood as, you know, projections of the mind.
I agree. And I think that's my understanding of it. I wasn't going to go there too far because I'm certainly not an expert, but my understanding of it is that, and my understanding also is that the two are resolvable in that the beings in those other states that we realize are transitional states towards that unifying state. So I don't go there too far because it's not my experience. I don't have direct experience with it, and also I just don't have the knowledge base in it. But I think that if I talk to a Buddhist scholar, and I have talked to several on the show, I kind of got a feeling that the Tibetan Buddhist would be able to resolve those differences pretty easily.
Yeah, you know, getting back to your question about superiority, or, you know, one is, you know, better than the other, you know, I don't think that's the case. I think, you know, that the Bible has been kind of relegated as, you know, a kind of non-psychedelic, you know, tradition. And, you know, the shamanic model and, you know, the Buddhist model have, you know, taken center stage when discussing the spiritual properties of psychedelics. So, you know, I'm going to be, you know, proposing the Bible as an alternative model, you know, one that's as, you know, useful as, you know, the other, and, you know, depending on one's propensities and interests and tastes, you know, could be, you know, more relevant.
Fascinating. And Rick, it sounds like there's a book in there. Is there an upcoming book on this?
Yeah, I'm about a quarter of the way through with it. It's called The Soul of Prophecy. I, you know, hope it's out, you know, by the end of the year. I mean, you know, that's my hope, and I think I can pull it off.
Great, great. And what other projects are keeping you busy these days?
Well, you know, that's it. I was, you know, working on the book, you know, full time until June last year, and I had a bunch of tragedies, you know, take place in my life. So I just took a break over the summer, but I got, you know, back to writing pretty much, you know, full time in October. So that's pretty much all I've been doing.
Well, it's certainly been great having you on Skeptico. It's just a fascinating topic, and what you've brought to it is really, really a gift to all of us. So thanks for all your work in this area.
Well, you're welcome. Thanks for the opportunity to talk about these things.
Thanks again to Dr. Strassman for joining me today on Skeptico. If you'd like more information about this show, including links to all our previous shows, please visit the Skeptico website. It's at skeptiko.com. You'll also find a link to our forum, email, and Facebook link to me, and a bunch of other good stuff. That's going to do it for today. Until next time, take care. Bye for now.